This episode of DC Entrepreneur is sponsored by Georgetown McDonough MBA, which offers both full and flex business programs. Find out more at choosegeorgetown.com/MBA.
Work, wealth, wisdom. This is DC Entrepreneur. We're sharing stories, ideas, and lessons from businesses in the pursuit of innovation. And we're helping build a community of problem solvers and thought leaders in the Washington area. Now, here's your host, George Macharko.
This is George Macharko, host of DC Entrepreneur. I'm speaking today with Jake Kramer. Jake is the managing partner of FedTech, which is a venture builder that thrives at the intersection of U.S. entrepreneurship, breakthrough technologies, and mission-driven organizations. Since 2015, they've been facilitating deep tech ventures across the DoD, NASA, Department of Energy, universities, and federal labs. Thanks for joining me today, Jake.
Sure. Great to be here, George. Thanks for having me.
So, Jake, just for those that are out there that don't know, what is FedTech and how do you all work as a venture builder?
Yeah, thanks for asking the question, George. So FedTech is an organization that we're a venture builder in essence, and we strive to really create new businesses, accelerate existing businesses, and change organizations fundamentally, small and large, really through activating the entrepreneurial mindset of every human that we feel is in every human, and we want to make that come out and cause really great things to happen, like improving economic situations, improving organizations, operational efficiencies, innovation in general. So we do that through our four different business lines. And so the first one is Startup Studio. This is where in our Startup Studios, we find technology that's created by the government, and then we pair them with entrepreneurs, take them through a really intense business model validation program. And if everything's promising, we help launch them and launch new companies. Then we also have the second one is our Accelerator Program, where we take existing companies, small businesses, and startups, and bring them through our programs. We have one with the Army. We have one with Oak Ridge National Lab, which is Department of Energy lab, and then we help them accelerate their growth and become more interconnected and helping out those specific agencies and sponsors. And then we have our internal innovation. This is our third business line. This is partnering with large organizations to help them realize the potential of their entrepreneurially minded people through innovation training, helping with new product development, those kinds of aspects of really improving the organization by really leveraging that entrepreneur mindset. And then our fourth one is our corporate venture arm, which where we find and we help Fortune 100 companies get access to the type of technology that we see every day. So that's coming out of the federal labs, coming out of new companies we build, or companies that come through our accelerator programs.
Okay, so for those that are out there that don't know, what are the federal labs? What do they do and how do you work with them?
Yeah, so there are over 300 federal labs in the country, and so there's just a ton of really, really smart scientists, engineers, researchers that are building new technology. And so the U.S. government spends about over $150 billion a year on research and development. So that is the government putting in a lot of money every year to create new technologies. And so that's what a federal lab is. And so we work with them by understanding the technology that they're producing, understanding the inventors, the tech transfer folks, and understanding where the best technology is, which ones are the most suitable for new companies. And there's actually two laws that were passed that were really, really important back in the 80s, 1980. One of them, the Stevenson-Wiedler Technology Innovation Act, and that was basically telling federal labs whatever they're creating, they have to budget in for tech transfer activities, meaning they have to release that technology to the world, and it's mandated, federally mandated, that they do that. The second one is the Bayh-Dole Act, and this is a really important act, which it does a couple of things. So one, it allows anybody, any kind of business, to license those inventions that are owned by the federal government. So they create technology, put millions of dollars into one technology. You can go as an entrepreneur, as a company, license that technology and use it for your own commercial purposes. It also allows the labs to keep some royalties to fund more research and reward inventors. So it incentivizes inventors to commercialize their technology, because they get a paycheck if the technology is successfully commercialized and selling to customers.
Are startups actually commercializing these ideas, inventions, through that tech transfer process?
Yeah, so we really help in that, and what we do is very unique and different from a lot of other companies that have accelerator type programs, and that we find the technology first. And so we find a great technology. We don't necessarily have the problem defined yet. So in traditional startup studios, they identify the market opportunity and then build something towards that to solve that problem. We do the other way around. And a lot of times it doesn't work. A lot of times it's not the right solution for said problem. But a lot of times it does. And so we find really advanced technology and think, how can we possibly identify a problem that this technology can solve. And we use several methods. We use a lot of lean startup techniques. We use a lot of customer discovery, getting out and talking to a lot of people, understanding at a deep level what kind of problems they have in their businesses and what kind of how they're currently mitigating those problems or dealing with those. And can the technology improve that problem, solve that problem, make their lives a little bit easier and better?
Yeah. So it's interesting. So you start with the technology and then you find an application for the technology and find out if there's a market for it, right?
That's right. Yeah. And a lot, and actually, and I forgot to mention one thing too, in that a lot of these technologies that are created out of the labs, they don't come as a fully packaged product. So there's three stages of development, really, and basic research, or three stages of research, really. So basic research, and this is just curiosity, trying to push the boundaries of what currently exists without solving a problem. And then the next phase is applied research. And this is research where you have a problem identified and you're trying to develop a technology to solve that problem. And then the third stage is development. And so the commercial sector focuses much more on development, and that's increasing the technology level. So essentially, you know, moving the technology much closer to product. And so the government plays in a much more on the basic and applied research side, and commercial sector usually spend much more money on development side and sometimes the applied research if they're large enough companies. And so we come in and help bridge that gap, because there is a gap between, you know, core technology and finished product. And so we find that technology that's not a perfectly packaged, you know, iPhone, right? It's maybe has some of the core technologies in it, like that were actually invented by federal scientists and federal funding, like the microprocessor, GPS, the internet, lithium ion batteries, a lot of components in your actual iPhone were created or funded by federal research dollars.
Yeah, it's interesting to me. I mean, there's really cool technologies that have come out of government research. Like you said, with GPS technology, the internet came out of it. Memory foam, right? That's one thing, right? You know, that basically it was the NASA technology and they found a commercial application for it. What kind of tech that we're familiar with have come out of federal labs?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many, as you mentioned. I mean, most people don't realize that, Google search engine, that was originally funded by, I think it was DARPA, but I'm sure I'll get corrected on that in the future, but it's definitely federally funded. There was a grand challenge. I don't know if anyone remembers this, but DARPA put on a grand challenge that basically said, you know, we want to get into autonomous driving and self-driving cars. And so we're going to have this huge challenge, and anybody can come, and a lot of universities entered the competition, had their own outfitted cars. This was in the early 2000s, I think. And basically the first event happened. They have to navigate this course, this, you know, many mile long course. And the first grand challenge, I think you know, they got like a mile or something really, really small. And then, and that was like the furthest one. But then the year after, they had many teams compete and actually win actually complete the entire course. And it just got much better after that. So a lot of it's really putting a lot of money and time behind some of these really moonshot ideas that become reality eventually when you get enough people interested and you get enough people seeing that there is potential there.
So now you specifically work with deep tech, right? Or deep technologies. Can you just explain what deep tech is?
Sure. Yeah. So deep tech, there's a lot of different names for it. Emerging tech, hard tech. It's really technology that takes the technological innovation to the next level. It's really improving on, you know, the physics of that technology. So we're not talking about an application of a current technology. So, you know, something like a social dating app, which you know is creating new algorithms, sure, but it really doesn't technologically advance the algorithms to a significant a level. So we're talking about things that are pushing the boundaries of what currently exists, and so that is the space we play, and that's a lot of what the federal labs do. Not everything that they do is deep tech, but certainly there's quite a lot of that, and that's a lot harder to commercialize than something that's software app based.
Yeah. So I mean, this is like AI, machine learning, right? Blockchain, probably, biotech.
Yeah, there's just so much technology coming out that deals with healthcare and from the government, because you know you would think only NIH or a National Institute of Health or HHS are the only agencies dealing with creating new technology. But if you think about it, every single agency has humans involved in that agency. So, for example, DOD, a lot of technology they create is healthcare focused because their main asset is people. And same with NASA and DOE. And so there's a lot more that people don't realize what's actually coming out of the labs and the kind of technologies. And also some of the technologies too is the really deep tech that's really hard to do and requires a lot of very specialized machinery, specialized knowledge, like material science is huge. Really hard to get to reproduce some of that in a startup environment or having the capital to do that. MRI was created also out of labs. The Human Genome Project was started in labs. A lot of really, really cool stuff coming out of it.
You're an innovative entrepreneur, but you don't want to put all of your eggs in one basket. In fact, you still want to pursue your education while building your business. As a Georgetown MBA student, you'll have access to all that Washington, D.C. has to offer, from top thought leaders to the world's largest multinational corporations. When you choose a Georgetown MBA, you can feel confident that you're getting a good return on your investment. Last year's graduating class once again secured impressive starting salaries with offers from top employers. Diversity and inclusion are essential to the Georgetown MBA experience. From day one, you'll interact with classmates who contribute a variety of professional, personal, and cultural perspectives. You can choose between the immersive full-time program or the innovative flex program, which is a part-time program that you can complete in as little as 26 months, advancing your career without pausing it. Explore the full-time and flex MBA programs and discover how Georgetown McDonough can help you launch the career you want at choosegeorgetown.com/MBA. So now, how do you teach entrepreneurs to create a business? And why does the Startup Studios program choose to use the Lean Startup model?
Yeah, so this is a good question. And it's kind of the first thing that we see and the data shows that the big thing why startups fail are there is no market need. And so we can dive into what that specifically means too, whether it's the wrong timing or the product wasn't marketed correctly or designed correctly. But in essence, there is no market need. Well, how do we figure out if there's market need? Well, there's a couple ways to do it. One is to whittle away on your invention in your garage, spend a year and put $1 million into it and release it to the world and hope that it has this great need. We tend to do a little bit more lean in that we essentially try and figure out what the problem is first. And we do that by talking to people, talking to customers, talking to potential users, to potential buyers, to influencers, to saboteurs who don't want to see your product come to market, and understand at a deep level, in an unbiased way, what is the problem they're currently facing? And we do that through a series of questions that are selected very, very carefully to not bias their answer. So we generally start very broad and ask questions like, you know, tell me your experiences as it relates to shopping. If you're coming up with some kind of, let's say, consumer grocery app or something like that, right? Start really broad, and then they start talking about their problems. You keep asking questions about, well, why is that an issue for you? And so you're kind of an anthropologist at this stage, and that's even before building a company, because you want to first identify if there's a need for that before you spend any time building any kind of technology or thinking about the design of it. You really have to collect that data up front first, make a decision whether, okay, yes, there is a significant need for it or there isn't, or we need to pivot. And a lot of times our technology that comes in our cohort can have multiple use cases. So we bring in coaches, mentors, technical experts, and identify which one has the strongest problem, who has their hair on fire problem, we call it, and then we start thinking about, do we want to actually pursue it? Now it seems like there's a large enough market, the interest is there, the current solution, this is 10 times better than the current solution, we can get it to market in this time. So it's a lot of different factors, but in the end, we help them by making a call, and they make the call of is there a promising opportunity to proceed? And then if so, then we help get them started. Yeah.
And so now you select 20 teams, about 20 teams for each cohort. What can entrepreneurs expect during the cohort, and what makes for a successful team?
Yeah, I mean, so it really, 20 teams, it's maybe that's an average, but we have many different cohorts of startup studios. So, you know, we have our FedTech startup studio, which brings in multiple sponsors, like Veterans Affairs, National Nuclear Security Administration, Department of Energy. And then we have specific cohorts too that are just client specific. They're only just one agency. So for example, we have our NASA startup studio. We have our DoD focused one, which is called the Defense Innovation Accelerator. And so, you know, and we have NIST involved in our FedTech startup studio. And we're just going to be launching actually a brand new one that's a DHS only startup studio as well. And so all of those teams vary, and also the timing varies as well of how long it's going to be. So, you know, it can be anywhere from 8 weeks to 24 weeks, really, depending on the program there. We do some pretty thorough vetting first of the technologies, which is behind the scenes. So the entrepreneur won't see that, but really I encourage them to come to our website, fedtech.io, and apply and look around and see which programs are open. We'll basically screen your application first. We're experimenting now with a one-way interview to start off with, which is where we have a series of questions. You'll record your answers through this program. We'll see that. And then we'll determine if we want to continue going forward and exploring this path, and we'll let you know the technologies in the cohort. You'll apply to them as a secondary application of which ones you want to be paired up with or at least are interested in. You have to select a minimum of one, obviously, and then the next thing is a one-on-one interview to see, would you be a good fit for that team. We also get to understand your personality, and we have a way of doing some kind of a psychometric testing, which will understand what kind of team player you are and how you fit in with the team. Are you a driver? Are you a captain? Are you a planner? Are you a scheduler? And all these different things. We want to make sure we have very complementary and diverse teams. Those tend to be the best. And then once you're admitted, we have now, since we've moved to virtual, we have one day on a weekend where we bring in the inventors, the mentors, all the entrepreneurs, and we basically have a big virtual session where we do a lot of team building, team norms, and really establish that bond at the very beginning. And then throughout the program, we have weekly meetings. We have assignments. We have lectures. We have that they can watch on your own time. And we really just shepherd you along and really guide you and challenge your assumptions throughout the entire program. And by the end of it, if you know, if you want to start a company and you know, we help them, we help them get started. We help them license technology from the government. We help them, we show them how to incorporate and how to start new companies and what are some of the legal aspects around that as well. So really, really from, you know, from inception to company launching, applying for investment through something called SBIR, Small Business Innovation Research, or private investors, so venture capitalists, angels, things like that.
Yeah. And so you mentioned this just real briefly about having the interviews done through an online format. How else has FedTech adapted its formats for the COVID-19 era?
Yeah, so it's interesting. We have not slowed down at all, and we've just been able to go full speed ahead and grow our company, grow our business, and it's been really, really fun. And what we've seen from the entrepreneur side is that people are generally more available to talk about these interviews because they're generally at home and not, you know, being interrupted by coworkers or not having to be physically in a meeting present. And so they can block off time a lot easier that way and spend some time once you get them on the phone, talking to them very quite a bit. And some, you know, 15-minute calls go an hour and a half sometimes. And so we found that to be much better actually during COVID in terms of the duration of the folks, because nobody's traveling either, which makes it people's schedules more available. The things that make it a little bit harder in what we've seen is that a lot of what we've encouraged teams to do in the past is to go to conferences, because those are just gold mines for talking to potential customers and understanding their needs. So the volume of people is a little bit harder because everything is done virtually. But once you get them on the phone, it tends to be a lot easier in terms of duration, getting some really good information. This is an entrepreneur's time, I think, right now, and that, you know, overcoming and adapting is what is the name of the game here. And right. The most successful ones are just persevere and we'll find a way to get it done no matter what.
Yeah. That's really interesting. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. Yeah. I would imagine like having to adapt, you know, is something that it is part of technology, and we're using the technology right now to record this. So, but I wonder now too, with teams, how are they able to do that kind of team communication? Do you help facilitate that as well? Or is it just they have to set up their own calls and meetings and everything outside of that?
Yeah, we have them, we give them the frameworks for it. You know, we tell them, you know, how often they should meet at a minimum. And so we hold them accountable that way. But as far as, you know, making sure that they're talking or getting in their meeting, well, our feeling is, you know, we'll hold your hand to a certain degree. But if we have to really, you know, set up a meeting for you to meet your own team once a week, entrepreneurship is probably not for you. And so we kind of transition them as they move along to less and less handholding and more just, you know, self-starter. And the interesting thing to note here too is that the people that we recruit, not all of them are you know, serial entrepreneurs. You know, we have the cool thing about our program is that our startup studio program is that this is a part-time thing at the beginning. You know, this is an extracurricular activity. You don't have to pay any money. We don't take any equity. We're fully funded by our agencies that we run these programs for. And so all you have to do is show up and you know, your time is what you're paying. And so, you know, folks who are mid-career or senior executives at large companies, sometimes public companies or in the C-suite, we, you know, this is their first foray into entrepreneurship. And so, you know, so it's definitely a friendlier way than others, other paths of just, you know, walking out of their job and saying, I've got this great idea. And so
it de-risks it, basically. You're de-risking kind of the idea. Yeah.
Totally. And it really de-risks it. And what we found in that by de-risking, we're able to open up the aperture, open up the circle of potential participants to be almost anybody that's interested in running a business for themselves. And, you know, interested versus making the leap, there's a huge gap there in that. And so, you know, a lot of the other startup studios we talk to and accelerators are saying talent is the biggest problem for us. And for us, it's not that big of a problem because it's such a low bar to at least join our program and see, hey, will this work out? Worst case scenario, I pick up some really good skills that I can take back to my corporate job. Best case scenario, I start a company and meet some really cool people and we launch a product and you know, live the American dream.
Yeah. That's, I think the attitude right there that you mentioned is really what comes into play, because if you're doing a team, you're going to have technical experts that have really deep knowledge of a subject area. Right. Probably people that have PhDs in a certain area. And then you have business leaders that may not have like the technical depth of expertise, but know how to drive forward an idea and know how maybe to market to people or, you know how to like, you know, really pitch an idea. Right.
Yeah. And it's interesting you mentioned that because the PhDs are always the hardest to get into the program, but we do have, I think, anywhere from 10 to 20% of those deep experts there. And what we tell them, you know, what we tell everybody is, you know, the team that we build for you in the beginning doesn't mean you, when you come into the program, you're not signing the dotted line, creating a company with this team, and this is the best team for this product that you're entering. Because some of these, we don't know what industry they're going in. So if they have expertise in finance, and it turns out the product is actually better for industrials, that may not work out well. So you could learn it for sure. But a lot of times you have to change your team throughout the program and at the end of the program or in the middle. And basically, okay, we need to bring on an expert in this, you know, and really the key thing is, you know, we bring the inventor in too. So the inventor is the one who actually has the most technical deep expertise, and they can go to this inventor for technical questions. But at this point, they're not launching a product. They're determining, is the opportunity sufficient enough to keep pursuing it? And that's the big thing. And if it is, then we look at, okay, what does it take to actually launch this company? When do I need to bring on an expert here? Can I hire some postdocs? Do I need to get investment? And so there's certain needs for the technical expertise. We definitely need it at some point. But just to get started, the inventor actually provides a lot of that, fills up that gap if we have a team that doesn't have a deep technical expertise in that specific field.
So it sounds like they can outsource some of those roles there and just try to build a deep bench. So can you just talk real quick about how the startups are funded through the program?
Yeah, so we don't have direct funding to them. So so right now, you know, the program, since they're not paying any fee or we don't take any equity, you know, the thing that we don't provide any additional monetary funding. However, some of our teams have gone on to raise over $2 million in funding. And a lot of that is through our network of angel investors. But more importantly, I think the first thing we try and do is have them apply to SBIR grants. SBIR, Small Business Innovation Research. You can go to SBIR.gov for more information. This is a government program. They call themselves America's Seed Fund, I believe. They have over $2 billion every year allocated directly to small businesses. So the idea here is you have a technology, you have a solution, and you can solve an agency's problem. So an agency like DOD will say, you know, through the Army, they'll say, you know, and this is all public, the Army will say, but we need this new type of armor to solve this type of problem. And they're going to post it online. Well, you as a small business can then go search SBIR.gov if you're creating new armor and say, and submit a proposal and say, hey, we have this technology that could be very relevant for you. And then so what they do is they'll do every SBIR is three phases, and in the first phase they award phase one to about anywhere from 10 to 20% roughly of the applicants a phase one award, which goes anywhere from $50,000 to about $150,000 of non-dilutive funding, meaning you don't have to give up any equity. And that first phase is really for understanding you do a feasibility assessment of your technology. So it's really an on-paper exercise to determine, does this technology, can it solve this problem that this agency or branch is having? And the second phase is anywhere from, I believe, 750,000 to 1.5 million, again, depending on agency. And that is really to create a prototype and be able to show that prototype to that agency or branch and have them assess it. And then phase three is a full contract with that government participant, the government customer. And there's no limit to how much they can award there because it's a contract with them. So it's all a really, really good, really, really good way to get additional money for funding your research. And, you know, going to a venture capitalist at this stage is just way too early for any to really take a look at, serious look at, when you have no traction. You just have a core technology and an idea of where it can be applied to.
Yeah. So can you just talk about some of the startups that have been created from the FedTech programs?
Yeah. So we have one that was Microsphere Material Solution, which they got phase two SBR. They have over $1 million in funding now, which is really a hollow metal and glass sphere. It's a single foam material, that basically allows the customers to reduce the vehicle weight, increase payload, and develop stronger vehicles. So this was a technology that was licensed from the Navy. They were able to scale up the manufacturing of this. They went from like a cigarette size roll of this foam to giant giant pizza cylinder rolls, and just huge things. And they're able to actually work with a underwater autonomous vehicle manufacturer implementing this foam in their actual product, and that product was then sold back to the Navy. So this is the case of license a technology that would otherwise have probably just been sitting on the shelf in the Navy somewhere, because Navy, the government doesn't take technologies from core technology breakthrough all the way to product. They need someone to take that technology, develop it, and then sell it back. And so this is example, taking technology from the Navy, scaling up, manufacturing it, mass producing it, and then selling it back to the Navy, impacting the Navy's mission there too. So that's really cool. We've got another one that's called Health Real. This is a former NFL Super Bowl champion that joined our program. He's raising a Series A round now. It's basically taking a technology, a blend of algorithms, and combining it with computer vision from NASA to look at a lot of different data points on your body, scan your body, and includes information about your body composition, metabolic data, health risk information, and recommendations. So that's another one. We have another one that's just the last one here. It is Direct Kinetic Solutions. This was an isotopic battery that can power CubeSats, IoT sensors, really reducing the hardware weight compared to standard battery devices, provides uninterrupted power, and can be super, super small. So this is a new way to get power to small objects that really are in harsh environments that you don't want to go out and replace these batteries or recharge them, is by using this new radioisotopic battery.
Those are all really cool examples there. Yeah, it's fascinating. And so you mentioned the development part of the R&D process. I mean, is essentially what the entrepreneur is doing kind of the development part, the D part of R&D?
Yeah, great question. So we have technology. We select technologies that come in. The government uses this scale called TRL, Technology Readiness Level, and it's 1 through 9. And so we have 9 being the most developed, and 1 being just an idea on a napkin, essentially. And so we have technologies that come in anywhere from 3 to 9. And so it really depends on the type of technology that come into the program. However, some are really ready to go as soon as the program's over, basically, and others require a lot more investment and development there. So there's actually another type of thing before you can license the technology called a CRADA, C-R-A-D. This is a Cooperative Research and Development Agreement. And this allows the startup company to partner with the lab, leverage the inventor's time and also the really advanced machinery to actually develop and further develop this technology. So depending on the needs, the technology can be developed on their own or with the lab. And so, or even just, you know, putting the finishing touches on it, packaging as a product and ready to ship it. And others are actually building apps or GUIs on top of the technology, on top of the algorithms to also launch it too. So the short answer just varies wildly.
FedTech itself is a startup. You and Ben Solomon are the founders. Can you just talk about the story behind the FedTech founding? How did you go about building your team?
Yeah, so it's interesting you mentioned that. So I was getting my MBA. I just finished my MBA and I was working in an investment bank in New York City, and I just, you know, got exposed to entrepreneurship, started exploring, I was a former military officer myself, coming from that background, thinking, you know, I had discussions with some of my classmates getting my MBA, and thinking that there's so much great technology out of these labs. Why aren't there more companies created from this? And that was my initial thinking. And so, you know, we were workshopping some ideas with some of my classmates, and was thinking there's a huge opportunity here. And then and then I met somebody through my MBA network, actually, that somebody had started a company already on doing this. And so, and that was Ben. And so I thought, well, should I start something myself or join someone who had already started a company? It was just him at the time. But he had some initial interest and had initial clients signed up with the DOD, and so he was looking to build the team out, and so I joined him, left a very safe job, and just thought, you know, this is going to be a fun journey, and so Ben and I got together, and then we started, you know, building out more the infrastructure more and more, and getting it better and better, iterating over time. It was just me and him for a little while. I can't remember how many years, but just a few years. And then about a year and a half ago, we started getting a lot more growth. And it went from basically me and him to now about 20 people on the team, and building out all new business lines, evolving, iterating, and building a culture that we, you know, strive to live in, and sharing the values that we've developed, and it's just really great to build out such like a great team. We have just an all-star cast of people, and it's just a lot of fun at this stage.
And are there any ideas of maybe like potentially growing from different programs, or what's kind of the idea? Do you intend to scale from here?
Yeah. We're definitely scaling. We've been approached with investment, but our revenues are sufficient now that are funding our growth. So we actually don't need investment, nor do we want investment at this point. But we're seeing a lot of growth in our corporate venture arm too. So companies that just really want to see a lot of times they don't get to see what's in the labs, and because it's a really decentralized beast, and it's not one organization. There's no such thing as, you know, the federal government lab organization. It's all very fractured, and there's not a lot of crosstalk among different labs, especially in different branches, like, or different agencies like DOE and DOD, you know, communicating with the VA. There's just not a whole lot of that. So we're kind of able to see from a bird's eye view and down at a worm level of everything that's happening. And so they're seeing a lot of value there, and the technologies that we bring to them are just really exciting. And then also, you know, we're thinking about the idea of raising a fund ourselves to do some seed investments for some of the companies coming out of our startup studio, so then we can help them even further grow and be successful too. And then we've got some international interest as well from other countries. So yeah, the problem is not is not revenue on our side. It's kind of where exactly we want to go, and how can we hire quick enough to kind of fuel that growth. And we're seeing now this is probably the richest talent market in the history of humankind. I'd go on a limb and say that, because there's been such great people that have been laid off due to the pandemic that are through no fault of their own, just being in a bad industry an industry that was really badly impacted by COVID. And so so the talent is just tremendous out there, and so are the applications. So yeah, keep them coming. We're still looking for people. So
now, you just briefly mentioned that you worked in investment banking, and you also worked at NextGen Venture Partners. Since you worked in venture, can you just talk about, from a VC point of view, what makes for an attractive pitch from a startup?
Tough question. So I'm a venture partner at NextGen Ventures. So I do see a lot of companies, CEOs that are pitching their companies. And I think there really is something to be said for being genuine. I mean, there's so many different avenues I can go down here, but I think the emotional intelligence of someone when they're pitching is so important, of being able to clearly not just to articulate your value proposition, but be able to answer questions directly and honestly, because there's you can't possibly cover everything in your pitch to investors. So you know, be open. If the worst thing that I've heard is we have no competitors, and you know, and when people ask, like, okay, you didn't mention any competitors, if you say we have no competitors, then you really just haven't done enough homework, because you know, if you're the first one to release a Microsoft Word or something, and you say you have no competitors in the note-taking software industry, well, you know, there's something else you didn't think about, which is there are other options to not using your software. You can use pen and paper. You can use your brain just to memorize it. You know, it's not just about equivalent products. It's about how what you're trying to achieve is being solved by the current solutions, and how are you different from them too. So so the articulation of competitors is really, really important. Even ones that are not, you know, directly related, or on the surface there. So. So I think that's important. I think also knowing your investor is important, and you know, pitching to an investor, or you know, I get LinkedIn messages all the time that, you know, that don't really understand my expertise, and they're pitching me on something that I have no idea anything about, and it's just so far from anything that I have enough knowledge to even comment on. So you know, so I think doing a little bit of research, and especially if it's like hi, and then you don't have, you know, they don't even know your first name, or don't even write your first name, and could tell it's just a copy and paste to as many investors as humanly possible, you're going to get just about zero responses from that. So knowing what the person actually cares about, and knowing their name could help as well.
Yeah, that's actually really great insight there too. So thank you for that. So anything else you'd like to add, and how can they get in touch with you?
Yeah, so I think the couple of things I mentioned too, we're still hiring. So go to our website, fedtech.io, or go to our LinkedIn page as well. And FedTech, one word. Check out our job openings. We're really growing and looking for great people. We also have upcoming cohorts too. So check our website, apply as an entrepreneur to our program, apply as a mentor. If you're interested in any of the other programs I talked about, just reach out to us. You can reach out, you sign up for our newsletter. It comes out about once a month. You can write to us also at hello@fedtech.io, and reach out to me on LinkedIn too. So that's it for me, Georgia. Thanks so much for having me. It's been a really fun talk, and great to get to speak to your listeners directly. I'm a fan of the show as well, so thank you.
Yeah, thanks for being a guest.
Sure.
We'll catch you next time on DC Entrepreneur. Visit the show at dcentrepreneur.com and follow us on social media at facebook.com/bizpodcast. Please tune into our next episode, and thanks for listening.